World Health Organization says almost 26 million people have been affected by the recent quake in Turkey and Syria. Russia calls on NATO to hold an emergency summit over the recent findings about the September explosions of the Nord Stream pipeline. And tens of thousands of teachers rally in Portugal's capital, Lisbon, demanding a pay rise. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. It's 6 days since a powerful quake hit Turkey and Syria. Over 28,000 people have been confirmed dead, and the death toll is still rising. Officials and medics put the toll in Turkey at over 24,600 and in Syria at above 3,500. The UN aid chief, who has visited Turkey's quake-hit area, says the number will double or more. He says the quake was the worst to hit the region in a century. Tens of thousands of rescue workers are scouring flattened neighborhoods despite freezing weather. The World Health Organization says almost 26 million people have been affected by the quake. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, earlier joined us for an update on the relief efforts in Syria.
And we know that many countries have been trying to help Syria since this earthquake hit the country. Up till now, more than 60 airplanes coming from over 20 countries have landed in various Syrian airports, loaded with humanitarian aid, on top of which, of course, those countries are Syria's allies and friends like Russia and Iran. Humanitarian aid is being distributed as much as soon as possible by the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, and even NGOs and ordinary people have been trying to help as much as they can, exerting efforts, whether providing what they can with the food and medicine, or even trying to distribute alongside with the Syrian government and help those affected. However, more help is needed, but unfortunately, there are the sanctions on Syria by the United States and Western countries were not lifted. Nothing was probably offered from them, except for just yesterday, we heard that there were two airplanes coming from Italy that landed in Beirut, loaded with humanitarian aid for Syria. But search operations continue despite the fact that it has been 6 days, and hopes are fading for finding anyone alive still over there. But dozens buildings have collapsed totally, creating this disastrous situation in Syria.
Earlier, our correspondent in Istanbul, Rashan Saglam, gave us the latest about the situation in quake-hit areas.
It's the sixth day, and people are still coming out from under the debris alive. We still have hope, and of course, the rescuers still have hope. Just an hour ago, a man was rescued in Gaziantep city, and he is a 60-year-old man. He is handicapped, and he was rescued alive. So this still gives us some hope. Usually after the seventh day, people or the rescuers would stop looking for people or living under the debris. However, it is still working. And when speaking to experts, they said that this is due to the cold weather. Usually when it is in the summer or when the weather is hotter, it is harder for people to survive under the debris. But people are still coming out alive, which gives us a hope. If we want to speak about the logistically, the Hatay airport will be back, as per officials, to working next Sunday. As we know, the Hatay airport was severely damaged and is out of order now. It's not working. And it is very important for it to work again so that the medical support and any kind of support, nutritional support, can reach the Hatay area, because all the roads leading to Hatay are cut. The medical teams are using the small roads, which is taking them a lot longer to reach that area. So with the airport working again, it will facilitate the work of the aid people and the medical teams better.
The Iranian people from all walks of life have held rallies in many cities across the country to commemorate the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Saman Kujuri reports.
Iranians from different walks of life have participated in the commemoration rally from all parts of the metropolitan Tehran to the iconic Azadi Square to mark and celebrate the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and renew allegiance with the ideals of the revolution.
The Iranian nation toppled the US-backed Pahlavi regime 44 years ago, ending 2,500 years of monarchy in the country. The Islamic Revolution, led by Imam Khomeini, established a new political system based on Islamic values and democracy.
The celebration was held in Tehran and over 1,400 cities and 38,000 villages around the Islamic country.
We are here to support our country, and we are here to tell the U.S. to back off so that we can make more improvements in our country. We're going to support this government, this country forever. We're going to support our supreme leader. So you just have to stop interfering in our affairs. And we want to say that down with the U.S. because you've been the cruelest country in the world.
We celebrate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution to show the world that despite all riots and plots hatched by the enemies, our Islamic Revolution is strong and powerful. We love our leader and the Islamic Revolution and are ready to sacrifice our life for the ideals of our revolution.
Addressing crowds of people at Azadi Square, Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, said West's policy of imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation.
West's policy imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. The United States and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The Iranians managed to make the enemy's plots futile. The West, the U.S. in particular, stands accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region.
The demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country. Analysts believe that after 44 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic establishment, Iran has now been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom seekers and the oppressed nations of the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Belgian prosecutors charged another member of the European Parliament with corruption in an influence-peddling scandal that has shaken the body. According to the Belgian media, the lawmaker, identified as socialist Marc Tarabella, was detained on Friday. His other charges are money laundering and membership in a criminal organization. The suspect has reportedly denied charges. The European Parliament is located in the Belgian capital, Brussels. The country's authorities also arrested four people in connection with the so-called Qatargate scandal in December. Prosecutors say Qatar may have given them gifts and money to influence decision-making before the country was picked as the FIFA World Cup host. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Russia calls on NATO to hold an emergency summit over recent findings about September's explosion at the Nord Stream gas pipeline. Foreign Ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova says there is plenty of evidence obtained by journalists on the blasts and the motive behind them. On Wednesday, American investigative journalist Seymour Hersh said U.S. Navy divers destroy the pipelines on orders of President Joe Biden. The White House has dismissed the report as utterly false. Nord Stream pipeline sends gas from Russia to Germany. To discuss that further, we're joined by Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, who's joining us from Sweden. Also, we have with us Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, joining us from London. Let's begin with our guest who is joining us from Sweden. Sir, were you surprised to hear this type of news surfacing after a couple of months? Of course, when the explosions happened, there were lots of speculations.
No, there was nothing surprising about it at all. In fact, American policymakers have been saying this is going to happen at some stage, way back to the time of Condoleezza Rice, who said that it was the US aim to ensure that Europe developed a dependency on American gas supplies rather than Russian gas supplies. Biden and Victoria Nuland both said if there is a physical war in Ukraine, Nord Stream 2 will stop working. So these things are not a surprise at all.
So, Mr. Papadopoulos, how true do you believe these investigative journalists' reports to be?
Well, first of all, I should say this, that the Kremlin's call for NATO to investigate the act of sabotage against the Nord Stream pipelines will fall on deaf ears. Why? Because America is NATO and NATO is America. If the US one morning was to decide to leave NATO, then by the evening of the same day, the Western military bloc would no longer be in existence. In addition to that, the reason why NATO was established in 1949 was to, in the words of Lord Ismay, the first Secretary General of NATO, to keep the Russians out of Europe, the Americans down in Europe, and the Americans in Europe. So it is not in the interests for the Americans to instruct NATO to investigate the origins of the explosions which rocked the Nord Stream pipelines in 2022. And given the amount of evidence, very persuasive evidence, which has been compiled by independent journalists, it is evidently clear that the Americans have a case to answer for. But alas, NATO will not investigate the matter. Last year, the Russians called upon the United Nations Security Council to investigate the explosions, but the Americans and the British blocked that, which was highly telling and highly suspicious. Perhaps the United Nations General Assembly can discuss the matter. But even if that was to happen, no action would be taken against America because, of course, America is a superpower. The Americans have used NATO to assist them in achieving mastery in Europe, which has enabled the Americans to achieve mastery in the world. So no matter how much concrete and persuasive evidence emerges indicating American guilt vis-a-vis the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, nothing will happen against Washington.
Well, nothing may not happen against Washington, but that will definitely adversely affect the relations that Washington has, which is already tense relations with Russia. So how do you believe that can affect the bilateral relations between the two countries? Are we going back to a Cold War status?
Well, relations between America and Russia are absolutely atrocious. Yet, even though the Russians are aware that the Americans committed this act of sabotage against Nord Stream, the Russians understand that this matter will be effectively resolved on the battlefield in Ukraine. That is why the Americans attacked Nord Stream, to try and suffocate the Russian economy. If the Russians emerge victorious in Ukraine, which they will, then what happened to Nord Stream will just be another chapter in the very, very troublesome relationship between America and Russia. But we should also be aware that the attack on Nord Stream was not just an attack on Russia, it was also an attack on Germany.
Germany, exactly.
The Americans, the Americans have been pressurizing the Germans for many years now to halt their import of Russian natural gas and instead to import American liquefied natural gas. So again, that the Americans attacked Germany is yet another demonstration of how the Americans treat their own allies. Germany on paper is independent and sovereign, but in reality, the Germans are beholden to America.
Okay, so Mr. Simons, in your opinion, as Mr. Papadopoulos brought up this very interesting point that this was not just an attack on Russian pipeline, this was also an attack on Germany because they are the other end of this bargain. So how would that spell the future relations between the U.S. and Germany?
Well, what we've seen clearly during this Ukraine war and under Merkel, Germany was a vassal state of the United States. It had some small leeway of independent action in foreign and security policy. However, what we've seen under Scholz, Germany's become a client state. It has no will of its own. It is just mouthing exactly what Washington is telling it. And I mean, the Americans are clear about what their interests are. I mean, if we go back to Henry Kissinger, I mean, he laid it out perfectly that this idea of a friend and foe in international relations, when he said that the United States has no permanent allies nor permanent enemies, it only has permanent interests. And this is exactly what we're seeing here at a point in time when the United States' unipolar hegemony is in relative decline. So these actions in Ukraine and Europe, and likewise in China with Taiwan, these are attempts by the United States to claw back their hegemony again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden, also Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts with us. One of the biggest protests in Portugal in recent years, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets in Lisbon amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis.
I think the government will have no choice but to listen to us, and if we are persistent and if we do not abandon the fight, I'm convinced that the government will really have to listen to us.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. This, as a Portuguese education minister has said, that negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and expressed hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of the Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing decades-high inflation and is grappling with a cost-of-living crisis. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. departure. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the history of Qasr edifice, the story of a museum that has had so many ups and downs, dependent to the different utilization of the place. The journey from a luxurious palace, which was converted to a dreadful political prison and is now a museum. The story of the Qasr edifice is intertwined with some of the most turbulent and crucial years of Iran's history. And within the confines of its walls, it holds countless memories of suffering and struggle. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the documentary.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
During the time the prison was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's while some families knew their children were there.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davood Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Qasr prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
Savak's harassment and torture accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger, and continued to struggle to overthrow the decadent regime.
In 1974, student activities intensified and street demonstrations flared up. With draconian power, Savak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents. Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Qasr prison and others were overcrowded.
Inside prisons, clerics would shoulder a special burden to teach young prisoners and broaden their horizons.
Prominent religious scholars like Ayatollah Taleghani and others tried to attract other people rather than to reject them. Even a person who had caved in a little to Savak torture would get ablaze when associated with such great people.
Savak, long suspicious of clerics' activities in prisons and afraid of their success, began to hold them back.
Up to the year 1974, the circumstances were desirable for political prisoners because there was no separation between them. For example, Mr. Taleghani and other prominent figures were all in the same prison, with a young man sentenced to a few months for distributing communiques. Such a man would mix with them and get trained by them. The political prison had become the University of the Revolution. But after the year 1974, most of the religious scholars were transferred to Evin Penitentiary, to a place specifically for religious scholars in order to disconnect their relations with other prisons so as to prevent them from growing.
Identifying different political and ideological currents in prisons and sowing discord among prisoners were on the list of SAVAK's priorities. The main aim was to pit opposition leaders against one another, tarnish their reputations and drain them of power so they couldn't fight the regime.
SAVAK itself would provoke prisoners to discuss with each other and pit them against each other. So it was probable that a problem would rise between those people, and the winner was SAVAK. So to avoid such a thing inside prison, the prisoners tried to keep their unity, saying, "We have a common enemy, and in front of this common enemy, we have to be united and must not provide SAVAK with excuses."
By arresting political dissidents, SAVAK aimed to quench the raging flames of the revolution. But since almost all political prisoners were transferred to Tehran, the prisons became a hive of political activity. The prisoners were filled in on the latest gossip, news, or instructions and announcements issued by Ayatollah Khomeini by their families, who would visit them from every corner of the nation.
The best point of this prison had to do with meetings. A long, narrow corridor, a wall about 1 meter in height, with rails and nettings, and a distance of 1 meter with officers in between.
When they came here, they would stand behind bars, prisoners on this side. Imagine such a large number of visitors who wanted to talk to prisoners all at the same time in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, all of them wanted to talk and tell their things. How was it possible for them to do so in 10 minutes? That's while some prisoners and families had to exchange political information from inside and outside the prison.
Mr. Mansouri believes political prisoners have always been well informed about the country's affairs.
After all, political prisoners would try regularly to be up to date and have the best analysis of the issues. It may be interesting to know that we in prison knew much more about the country's issues than those who were outside prison. The reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave SAVAK more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, SAVAK stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does.
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture.
Not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked
not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
Within, I want to be very careful, not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. Above all, the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
The human rights must be absolute, but let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
During the U.S. presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were U.S. pawns to open political space and improve the image of the U.S.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new U.S. president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, "Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible." Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space, rather than diffusing the situation, helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches, and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
Firuzim,
Anyway,
as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the US had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government, but in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before. The US didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since SEVAK had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
On October 24, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and SEVAK agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garden Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude. But when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Ras Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place that's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. A witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
Well, with the drastic changes the edifice witnessed in the past 200 years, one can only wonder what will become of it 200 years from now. And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol, and today I want to talk a little about the feeling of fear. I need to note that whatever I say is based on the Quran and Islamic narrations. The feeling of fear is somehow a common emotion that exists within every individual. Fear is a part of our creation. Allah Almighty has created fear in our nature so that it prevents us from falling into dangerous situations. If there existed no fear in us, the result could be absolutely terrible and shocking. We would indulge ourselves in any risky and even extremely risky and hazardous condition. We would be like a numbskull man and would jeopardize our health, our wealth, and even our life. With no fear, we could become careless about everything. Consequently, if we see that we are cautious about making decisions, we are careful about our health, attentive about our future and the future of our family, they are partially related to the normal degree of the feeling of fear. Here one may ask that why do we need fear while we have intellect? And by using our intellect, the mentioned problems could be solved. For example, if we carefully think about a dangerous animal that is next to us, our intellect says that we should be cautious and we should do something. Then why should fear be added to it? The answer is that in most of the cases, when we face a danger, what is more effective for escaping from it is an abrupt and sudden emotion that erupts unconsciously in our body. Especially in situations that we have no time to think and analyze the scenario. For example, if an object is thrown towards our face, we, in a fraction of a second and totally unconsciously, close our eyes. Or if someone out of nowhere tries to attack us with a knife, suddenly our heart starts to pulsate more, the blood circulates more to give energy to our muscles to be able to run away faster, and many other reactions take place suddenly. They take place in our body without any attention. Even the blood runs away from our face to give more power and to deliver more energy to the muscles. These natural behaviors are due to the hormones of fear that secretes a little more in abnormal situations. As we see, these unconscious reactions have more benefit for us than the benefit we would take from using our intellect. Even our intellect in these sudden and unpredictable dangers does not work properly. So what is more practical is the emotion that performs its duty in a better way and without our attention. This is why Allah Almighty, who never does anything, never creates anything without wisdom, created the feeling of fear in our nature.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Let me here add a subtle point that there are many graces from Allah upon us, like the creation of fear, that we may be neglectful about them. But when we ponder more, realize how merciful Allah is. And thinking about these so-called hidden blessings helps us to be more thankful and show more gratitude towards Allah. I was talking about the feeling of fear and the positive side of it. A normal amount of fear is necessary for our living, and fear helps us to secure our life. Another benefit of fear is seen in what we describe it by having stress and worry. This is a kind of fear, a normal feeling of stress that emanated from fear helps us to be prepared for upcoming situations. For example, as it is proved, a 30% of stress for an exam, a kind of exam that we have next week, helps us to study more sufficiently. A little stress for tomorrow's public lecture assists us to be more prepared. The stress of losing a game or a competition supports us to become more competent. However, fear and stress, if they go beyond the normal degree, will lead to abnormal consequences. They can lead to mental or emotional strain or suspense. They may lead us to face depression, and they may prevent us from having a normal life. When fear disrupts or overtakes an individual's life, there are many strategies that can be taken. But one of the most helpful practices is to know we are not alone. Just think about the little baby that is sitting on his parents' lap. As long as he is sitting there, he is less likely to show fear of strangers who are around him. The reason for the baby's bravery is that he knows he is not alone. He knows he is with someone like his parents who can help him and support him if he needs help. Or for example, a father is hugging his baby and, for playing with him, throws the child up, and when the child is falling down, catches him. The common play that fathers do with their children. The baby not only does not usually fear, but also enjoys from this play and never thinks that his father may leave him and let him hit the ground. Not at all. The baby is totally certain that his father is with him up to the end of the play. And he does not feel to be alone. Totally the same. We also enjoy similar condition if we have the required faith in Allah. And if we realize that Allah is still with us, just as the same trust that a baby has in his father, we would become less stressful and less fearful. This is what Allah says in many verses of the Quran. For example, He says in Surah At-Tawbah, وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُتَّقِينَ. You should know that Allah is with the pious. Where Allah says in Surah Nahl, verse 128, إِنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الَّذِينَ اتَّقَوا وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ مُحْسِنُونَ. Indeed, Allah is with those who are pious and those who act righteously. If we put our trust in Allah and next to it also try to do whatever we should do, we should not be motionless. Then we can sense that it is very relieving, and this belief can alleviate our fear. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.